It is Friday, which means it's time to break down all the news that's been making headlines this week in our region. Joining me live in studio for today's Friday Reporter Roundtable are Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Press, and Seth Ogilvie with Idaho Public Television. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
We're only half here after five debates, Melissa.
I was going to say, you guys have been quite busy over at Idaho Public Television.
Just a bit.
Okay, so three debates this week, though. Lieutenant Governor, gubernatorial, and then State Superintendent for Public Instruction.
No, Congressional District 2.
Oh, that's right.
Right. Superintendent was last week. We had five debates.
I can't even keep them straight.
We had five debates in a seven-day span, which is the most concentrated debate schedule I've ever seen in the debate cycles I've been a part of at Idaho Public Television. It was pretty intense, I'm not going to lie. By Wednesday night, which was the last debate for this week, I was pretty fatigued. But we got through it, and we got a lot of really great feedback from voters who said that they learned some things that they didn't know.
So tell me about that, because the debates, you know, they got heated here and there.
Many of them did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and it was interesting because, you know, candidates were fact-checking each other or drawing out differences in ideologies and philosophies and in campaign positions. But more than anything, these debates showed candidates' temperaments. It showed their personalities, and it showed how comfortable they are speaking in front of people and delivering position statements, which is pretty critical for leaders.
And dealing with the questions, too, I thought we saw a lot this week on candidates who, as they say, answered the question they wanted to hear, not necessarily the question they got. And a lot of kind of, let's pivot to something that I actually do want to talk about. I think you saw that both in the second congressional district debate. I think you saw that in the superintendent debate. I think you saw that in the governor debate and the lieutenant governor debate.
Pretty much all of them.
I think in both the second congressional and in the gubernatorial debate, we asked flatly about ICE and immigration policy. And people wanted to talk not about the actual policy, but about wanting to have something as a solution. There were no like concrete actions that were attached to those things.
Mm-hmm. And that's not abnormal because, you know, these candidates, they're politicians and they're going to talk about what they want to talk about, not necessarily what we want to talk about. But it was, I did have my first debate, my first candidate say, you know what, I'm not going to do what the moderator wants me to do. I am going to take my own path. They said that. Yeah, literally said that on
you are
camera.
Kidding.
No. And it was kind of nice to have someone acknowledge that they were just flat out ignoring me. That was a nice change of pace. But
you're like, okay, mm-hmm. All right.
And I think those things really speak to the character of the people. Whether you want someone who's going to stand up, say, like, no, I'm in charge here. This is how this is going to go. Maybe that's someone you want to vote for. Or maybe you want someone who's going to maybe acquiesce a little bit more to the moderator. You want someone who's more polite. I think that does give voters a chance just on temperament of who they want to vote for outside of the politics.
And to be clear, this candidate wasn't just interrupting me. She was speaking over her opposing candidate and that sort of thing. So it wasn't just me.
You going to name names, Melissa?
Well, you know, there were only five of them. You can probably figure it out.
So let's talk about temperament then, because I do think that's a good point, and you definitely saw that during the debates. Mm-hmm. And I mean, let's start with the gubernatorial debate. And when we look at Brad Little and Paulette Jordan, I mean, there were times she was going after him about things that he did or did not do in office, and saying she really wants to make a change.
Right. There were many times during the debate. There were many answers where she would address what the reporter said and then turn to address Lieutenant Governor Little and say, we would be in a better position if you had acted during your time. He took exception to that. Excuse me. And you know, flat out said, well, maybe someday you'll learn what the lieutenant governor's position is. I mean, he got snarky back, mm-hmm. which was notable.
And I think it speaks specifically in the governor's race. These people are basically going to be the boss of a large organization in Idaho. Mm-hmm. They have the veto pen, of course, where they can veto legislation, and they have the bully pulpit to push legislation. But in actuality, like, their main job is being a boss. And being a boss, you have to get along with the folks. You know, whatever your leadership style, whether it's, you know, through force, through threatening, or through, you know, giving them treats and like getting them to do, you know, like whatever you might want to do.
But here's a cookie. Yeah.
At the end of the day, they're kind of the boss of Idaho, and the temperament of that person is really one of the most critical things of importance to get your job done.
And then when we go to the lieutenant governor debate, what I noticed with that was Paulette Jordan came up again during the debate, and there was some real back and forth with that against Kristen McCollum when she had come out in the very beginning of this saying, you know, that she would that kind of a joint ticket, even though we don't have a joint ticket in Idaho.
And yeah, Kristen McCollum definitely came out very hard as a joint ticket in the primary. And I think you actually saw that kind of help her get through that primary. But now she is backing away a little bit. And we tried to pin her down on whether or not that was because of things that the Paulette Jordan campaign had done recently. We've seen a lot of upheaval, whether she didn't agree with some of the politics. And she really didn't want to say why, and didn't want to say that she was stepping away from Paulette Jordan. But you could definitely see that she didn't want to be associated with Paulette Jordan nearly as much as she did in the beginning of the campaign.
Although she did say, like, look, we have different campaign schedules. We do different things. So I, you know, you could take what she says at face value, just saying, look, that once we found out that having a joint ticket wasn't a thing in Idaho, we did things differently that don't look too much into it.
But you'd hope that they'd have a fundamental knowledge that we don't have a joint ticket in Idaho when they went into it. I think it was more of a symbolic thing that these were two strong women that were running for office and this was kind of what they wanted to be seen as. I don't think that they had an actual like thought process in their head that you vote for both of us.
But also, you know, at some point, how much does it really matter, you know, especially considering the role of the lieutenant governor? How much does that really matter? There are so many other things that we can talk about. I think it's an interesting side note, but certainly there are so many other issues that Idaho's facing.
You know, one of the things, and I want to say it was a tweet, and someone pointed out that I believe it was the gubernatorial debate that Lieutenant Governor Brad Little was the only male up there. And that's, I think there's something to be said about that, because Melissa was the moderator, the reporters were female. That's a change when it comes to Idaho and how we look.
It's pretty rad as heck, I think.
Yeah.
I was a fan of it. You know, the interesting thing about that, and I addressed this online too, is it wasn't by design. We weren't thinking we want this team of all women superheroes going out there and defeating the patriarchy. That wasn't it at all. It's just that the reporters, Morgan Boydston of KTBB, Cynthia Sewell of the Idaho Statesman, and Betsy Russell of the Idaho Press were natural picks for the governor panel because of the coverage that they've done. And, you know, how many times, Gemma, have you and I been on panels or in meetings with all men?
Oh.
All men.
Too many times to count.
Right, exactly. And so I'm hoping that someday that won't be notable at all. You know, it's also, there were a couple
And that's
of,
a great point, that someday it won't be notable at all.
Exactly. You know, we've had two debates now where both of the candidates were women, superintendent and lieutenant governor. We only have one debate this cycle where both of the candidates are men.
And you look at the political press corps lately, and it has been a lot more women in it. I don't think this is a one-off event. I think you're going to see this more and more often. And then, yes, with a lot more female candidates getting involved in Idaho politics. I mean, we will have a female lieutenant governor, barring some sort of catastrophe. Mm-hmm. We will have that. I mean, that's something that we will have. We might have a female governor. We will have a female superintendent of public instruction. We might have a female secretary of state. And there are a lot of women
treasurer.
Involved. We will have a female treasurer.
Exactly.
And things are changing when it comes to gender and politics in Idaho. And I would echo Melissa. I think it's for the good. I mean, we need more voices involved in our state institutions.
And we still have a long way to go, certainly, when we're talking about, you know, House leadership, for example, with the majority party, Senate majority leadership, all men right now. We have a very long way to go when it comes to minority voices being represented in both the media and politics. So it's not like, hey, problem solved. We had all ladies on the governor
debate.
But we are very aware of that at public television. It's something that we keep an eye on.
And I want to bring Scott into the conversation. And let's change topic, Scott. Talk about the Idaho Department of Correction. They are modifying some prison space. And this goes back to the fact that we're seeing more female prisoners.
Right. You know, this is something that we noticed a few months ago
in Canyon County
when they are building steel cargo trailers in the parking lot of the Canyon County Jail to house female inmates. And at the time, this was maybe 3 or 4 months ago, the jail captain said that the number one growing population in the jail was women, and that they used to have 30 to 40 women a day in the prison. And now they're routinely over 100 per day, making up about 20% of their total jail population. So we started looking into it, and it is not just a Canyon County issue. And in fact, it's not just an Idaho issue. It is a nationwide issue going on. But in Idaho, it's becoming a little more acute because we have overpopulation already. And now with a growing percentage of women in the prison, we're talking 1,100 women are in the state prison system now, 13% of the total population. It's the fastest growing segment of the prison population. And this comes at a time when we are sending male inmates out of state.
Right.
We just sent another group of 150 prisoners to Eagle Pass, Texas. And there is a proposal for a $500 million expansion of the state prison system. And so what the Board of Correction did this week was they approved modifying dormitory. They call it dormitory space. I guess that makes it sound nicer, but remodeling it to accommodate female inmates. And they anticipate they're going to have as many as 1,400 women in the state correction system in the next 3 years.
Melissa?
You know, we've looked into this statewide at Idaho Reports, and you're absolutely right. It's not just a Treasure Valley issue in either Ada or Canyon County. We visited a jail in Custer County last year where they have only 6 beds for inmates. And if they arrest a female, they need to transport her hours away in some cases because there are just not enough beds. So it's bad in Idaho's urban areas, but it's especially exacerbated in Idaho's rural jails where they have no space. You also need female corrections staff. That's a really, really big issue that these small rural jails are facing because there are some duties that male employees cannot perform for female inmates.
And so, Scott, the goal then will be modifying this so they can then bring females into this space that was formerly for men.
Right. And they have as many as 90 to 100 women who are sleeping on cots, you know, all over the prison system. And so getting them dedicated facilities, restrooms and dormitory space and cell space for women specifically to accommodate the growing population.
And we're actually going to be doing a special Idaho Matters next Thursday on the 25th. My producer, Samantha Wright, and I actually went out to a minimum security prison in late summer, a female security prison, and to look inside the female prison system, because this really is an issue. I mean, nationwide, but in our state as well. Go ahead, Seth.
Oh, I just think in this year at the legislature, I think it's going to be probably one of the biggest issues. I mean, this is a huge amount of money that has to be spent for a jail. And talking to judges, they say if you build a jail, we're going to fill it. Mm-hmm. I mean, this will be used either way. And it's not something that's new. I mean, you go back to Otter's in the early time in his administration talking about hot bunking, where they were trying to use one bed for two people. I mean, we've had problems with our getting beds for prison population in Idaho for a while, and that's just being exacerbated by the amount of growth that we're seeing. We just need to expect some of these things to – we just need more of everything at this point.
It's also exacerbated by the opioid crisis. Every sheriff we talked to said that is the biggest reason they are seeing more and more and more women right now. It's opioids. And so when we're talking about solving this problem, it's not just bed space. It's trying to stop it on the front end when we're talking about opioids and how they're affecting communities.
And every single female prisoner that we spoke to was in for a drug charge.
Half,
every single one that we talked to at the prison that we went to.
Yeah, so the numbers that we had was that half of the female inmates were in for a drug charge, and then a high percentage of the rest had some sort of related drug issue. Whether they were in prison for robbery or assault or something, they had some sort of drug issue.
Mm-hmm. We are continuing our Friday Reporter Roundtable. Joining me live in studio are Seth Ogilvy with Idaho Public Television, Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Press, and Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television. We have gone over all of the debates Idaho Public Television has done in the, 7-day period, 5 debates. You have 2 specials coming up, one on Proposition 2, one on Proposition 1. Get me updated on the goal of that, because even in my own household, you know, it was like, how do I vote on these? I mean, I think people are still having conversations, and we are 2.5 weeks out from election?
Yeah, and I think a lot of that is because of how much money has gone into this. And at least with horse racing, you can get a different point of view on what this is going to do depending on who you talk to. I think when it comes to Medicaid expansion, I think people have a fundamental idea of what they're actually voting on. Mm-hmm. With horse racing, not so much. So my goal has been to kind of figure out what this thing will actually do, what are the regulations that will go behind it, how many tracks might we see, what impact might this have on communities. And even in those, like, seemingly these are just going to be facts, there's a wide breadth of, like, what the opinions are on mm-hmm. it. I talked to Jim Hammond from the Racing Commission, and they're not taking a position on whether or not they want to expand Prop 1 or not. But he told me flat out, if they don't expand Prop 1, Racing Commission probably doesn't exist in 5 years. I mean, there are a lot of people who are going to get affected by this, both on the state level and in person. You've got the mayor out in Garden City who's saying that this is going to have a huge impact on all the entertainment that's going on there. Why would you want to go bowling if you can go to a casino? And this is going to have weird effects on communities. And then there is the question of, how many races would you have to do? Mm-hmm. They say 8 race days. What does that mean? Would we see a bunch of other tracks popping up trying to get into the pari-mutuel gaming system to make money as a casino rather than make money on horse racing? The folks that are, you know, pushing this say that this is about horse racing. Is it just sustaining horse racing? It's not about the casino style gambling. But of course, the no side has a different opinion on that.
And I have to tell you, I mean, we have had numerous people right here on our program in talking about Prop 1 with horse racing. I still don't fully understand it because there are so many little caveats to it. The last time we had someone in, they talked about how the Greyhound racetrack up in Post Falls is grandfathered in to be able to have this. And I was like, what? Right. Where did that right. come from?
And most of the arguments are that if this, then this, if this, then this. And mm-hmm. they kind of go on, they spiral out of control when you start going down that. So you know that there's probably like the butterfly flips, you know, does his wings in China and we get a storm here. It seems like most of the arguments are kind of like that. I'm sure that it's somewhere in the middle. I'm sure that it's not going to be as catastrophic as some people say. I'm sure it's not going to totally save horse racing, as some people say. Somewhere in the middle of all this stuff. But yeah, it's incredibly hard to suss out the reality.
Some of those claims on Prop 1 are eyebrow raising, I'll say. You know, you look through the actual voter guide released by the Secretary of State's office, mm-hmm. and one of the arguments against Proposition 1 is gambling addiction leads people to kill their children by leaving them in hot cars. It led to the mass shooting in Las Vegas. You talk about butterfly effect. What?
Well, right.
No, exactly.
Right.
The hyperbole has reached a level that's, I mean, that's what you get, I suppose, yeah. when you, I mean, I have never seen this much money poured into an election in Idaho ever in my time.
So when will these specials be airing? Because I think it is critical that people get an opportunity to actually, you know, get more information than even just the voter guide, because the voter guide can be a bit overwhelming sometimes.
Well, and the voter guide, those arguments are submitted by people who have a vested interest in the campaigns themselves. And so they're not written by ideologically pure people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, secondary Medicaid didn't just go and say, here's the facts,
right,
here you go.
Exactly, right.
So the Medicaid expansion hour-long special is actually airing tonight, October 19th at 8 o'clock on Idaho Public Television. That's the one that I'm producing. And then the horse racing Proposition 1 is airing on October 26th, next Friday, also at 8 p.m. They're both hour-long specials. For Medicaid expansion, we're really trying to talk about what happens if we don't. What are some potential options? Why haven't we done anything about this before? And talk about how, you know, as we explored in our joint effort with the Idaho Statesman, how honestly even the best estimates can't adequately or accurately predict mm-hmm. what's going to happen in other states.
Right. And Scott, let's bring you into the conversation. So we have got scooters. Scooters seem to be everywhere all of a sudden. It's like we've given birth to scooters in the Treasure Valley.
Yeah, 450 scooters were unleashed on the streets of Boise this past week. Two companies, Lime and Bird, that had previously gotten approval to run a scooter, these dockless electric scooters in the city, hit the streets this week. There's a third company called Spin that's going to have another 250 scooters. And some of us who were out and about in downtown Boise yesterday, we saw that these are pretty popular. And Samantha was saying that there's dozens of them along Park Center Boulevard. So it's
at left, by the way, not just people riding them, but since they are dockless, they right. are just waiting to be picked up along the sidewalk.
Well, and ostensibly it would be somebody who's working in an office building here on Park Center Boulevard. They're going to take it back to their car or their apartment in the North End or whatever. But they appear to be extremely popular and doing very well in Boise as opposed to how it went in Meridian.
Because in Meridian, that was not good. The mayor came out very strongly against this.
Right, and they shut it down. They're hoping to possibly bring it back in the spring, but it did not go well in Meridian. There were complaints of blocking the sidewalks, blocking ADA accessibility places, mm-hmm. And so they just shut it down. Now, whether we see the same problems in Boise or not, you know, remains to be seen. This is just the first week. But people are out using them, and we're going to keep monitoring to see if we have some of those similar complaints.
And, I mean, you look across the country, and I don't think there's a good solution to this necessarily, if these are the problems we're trying to solve. I was in Nashville recently, scooters all over the place. I mean, just as we're seeing right here in the middle of the street, falling over in the sidewalk, hard to get around. In Baltimore, Melissa and I were there the other day, same thing, saw a bunch of the scooters just laying around. I was talking to a friend that was just recently in Southern California. They were saying not only are there a ton of these birds or scooters or whatever you want to call them laying around, a lot of people have actually started going in and cutting the brakes on them. So you really have to monitor what's going on with your scooter before you get out. That's why I think they make you take a photo of it to see that the scooter's right for the liability purposes. But I think there's a lot of us that would just get on a scooter assuming it's working properly. He got on a scooter, realized about halfway down the street that there were no brakes on it.
Oh,
so there are, and these are communities that have had these scooters a lot longer than we have and haven't really gotten to the bottom of how to solve these problems.
Well, what's interesting to me about this, though, is the dockless versus the docked, because with the bicycles in Boise, you have to take them back to a docking station. So we don't see them all over.
Right.
Dropped off. And I saw dockless bikes down in Scottsdale, and they're everywhere.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, arguably, that makes the docks make them less convenient, you know. So I'm going to take a scooter or a bike, and I've got to park it, you know, half a mile away from my office and then walk a half mile back mm-hmm. to my office. That's the beauty of the dockless, is that you can leave them right at your doorstep. But I think, you know, if people are going to use these and they want to keep them around, they're going to have to, you know, be polite and be courteous and handle them properly.
And I think, too, it's about obeying the rules of the road. and I say this as someone who was downtown recently with these and seeing these scooters going in and out of traffic and in and out of traffic. It was, you know, as just a citizen and then as a parent with my kiddos seeing this, I'm like, what's going to happen when there's an accident?
I'm such a curmudgeon. I'm so anti-scooter. I want to be on the record saying I am with you 100%, and I'll go a step further and just say I'm anti-scooter. They sound horrible.
Well, and there's no helmets, and we're such moms. There's no helmets, and there's
someone's going to hit
pads,
a child.
Elbow pads.
But no, someone. We had to move our children over mm-hmm. on the sidewalk yesterday because someone on a scooter was coming, and they were like, "Watch out! Watch out!" So it is going to be interesting to see how all of this plays out, I think.
And I think that gets to kind of, I think one of the fundamental questions we'll have to answer is it the problem of the scooter or is it the problem of the person driving the scooter? Like, what's really the problem here? Because I've almost got hit by people on bikes riding on sidewalks as well. I've almost got hit by people on those weird gyroscopic, almost Segway things going on sidewalks. I mean, people can be bad at driving or riding pretty much anything and put you at risk. It doesn't necessarily – is it the vehicle's fault or is it the person operating the vehicle's fault?
Well, maybe I'll just say that I'm anti-other people then.
It's easier.
Yeah.
Everyone, Melissa's coming downtown pretty soon. Everyone get off the street.
Everybody leave. So, Scott, when do we think that the third company will come in? And this is an interesting time of year to be coming in fall when we're going to go into the winter months.
Yeah, and maybe that's better. They're processing it now, and they think they'll be hitting the streets in the next two weeks or so. And so maybe it's good that we kind of get this out of our system and people stop for the winter and take a break. And then,
or they're going to try to ride them during the winter,
depending on what kind of winter we have.
Yeah, add ice into that system. They become a whole lot more safe.
Get some sweet studs on those scooter tires. I can't wait.
I'm just picturing Melissa actually pouring water so it freezes
scooter.
Yeah,
I would not.
She would not do that.
I would
that.
Not, sir.
Are you also anti-vandalism?
Yes.
All right, we're going to wrap this up. I want to thank all of you for coming in today. If you want to watch the two specials that Idaho Public Television is doing, the one on Medicaid is tonight at 8 p.m. on IPTV, next Friday on Proposition 1 about horse racing. Again, thanks to my reporter roundtable, Melissa Davlin, Seth Olvey, and Scott McIntosh. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks,
thank you.
Dad.